If everyone is sitting comfortably, then I'll begin. Today's talk, I want to talk about mindfulness in more detail. And I try and tailor these talks to actually what's happening in the meditation retreat, because I have a very clear purpose here and how I want to lead everybody into developing these peaceful and beautiful states of mind. And not only do I give instructions about the mind of meditation, but also not just how to do, but also to be what to be aware of, what to look out for, to see the obstacles and to see what empowers the meditation. And today I wanted to really go into much greater detail about this quality we call mindfulness, which is not the only quality which one needs for meditation, but it's one of the important qualities, and it's also one of the most misunderstood qualities of mind. The actual word mindfulness comes from the Pali called sati, and that word has a double meaning in the suttas, in the scriptures. It has the meaning of like being fully aware of what's going on, a sense of being attentive, of like almost like a complete knowing of the moment. But also it has the other meaning of a memory, what I usually explain as remembering the instructions. So in rough terms, it means in the context of meditation that not only do you know what you're doing, you also know what you're supposed to be doing when you're meditating. And very often that one or both of those knowings is completely absent, which is why the meditation doesn't really deepen and become all that successful. Sometimes there's a kind of knowing in the meditation, but it's not really clear, you're not really precise and bright on what's happening inside your mind. And secondly, that we forget what we're supposed to be doing. We can go off into all sorts of strange thoughts and go into all sorts of ideas. You should be watching the breath, and sometimes we go into fantasies and visions. And each of those occasions, we forget that this is not what we're supposed to be doing. We've lost our mindfulness. You might be fully aware of your thinking and your dreaming, but really you forgot the instructions. So mindfulness has those two aspects to it in the context of meditation. You know what you're doing, and you know whether it's what you're supposed to be doing. That is why in the teachings of the Buddha, he used a very powerful simile of mindfulness called the gatekeeper. And just to bring these metaphors up to date, sometimes I call it the bouncer of the nightclub. Because the bouncer of the nightclub has got to have the same two qualities. He's got to be really alert, because these hoodlums, these riffraff, can very easily sneak in to that nightclub and create trouble for the patrons. So he has to be very alert. And also he has to remember the instructions, so that he may have a list of the troublemakers. And he has to remember them. He has to remember them. They're very sneaky. And he has to be extremely alert to make sure they do not sneak in. And that's like the bouncer on your mind. So your mind is a nightclub, and I mentioned a nightclub because it's an entertainment centre, it's fun. You know, when you actually get mind in meditation, it's much better than a nightclub. And seeing as many people do their meditation at night time, that's why I call it like a nightclub. It's very wonderful in there, but you need that bouncer on the door. Otherwise you get into trouble. The other simile of type of gatekeeper, like a guard on your house. I've given this simile before, which is also a very powerful simile for mindfulness. If you do have like an expensive house with lots of valuable furnishings and jewelry and money inside of it, and so a lot of wealthy people have these guards on the gate, and the guards on the gate have to be alert and also remembering the instructions. Just alertness is not enough. In this simile, when people think mindfulness is just bare knowing, then this simile sort of explains why that's not enough. Because then you go off to a retreat and you tell the guard of your mansion, be careful, there's robbers and thieves around, be mindful. And then when you go back home, you find the house has been ransacked, the burglars have been in, they've taken all your furniture and possessions. And you ask your guard, your gatekeeper, weren't you mindful? And the gatekeeper said, yes, I was mindful. I watched the burglars going in, I watched them going out. I noted video going. I noted DVD going. I was extremely mindful all the time. I saw everything coming in and going out. Now, would you think that would be a good guard? Of course, you'd sack the guy. You'd probably send him to jail. That's not good enough. The guard has to follow the instructions as well. And he has to know what to do when these thieves and bandits come in. He has to try and make sure they don't get in the first place to keep them out. If they do come in, to do something to try and get them out of the house, call the police or something, if he can't get them out by himself. And also actually to protect the house, to make sure that... Now, one good way of protecting a house from thieves is always to have some friends there. That's why when people go, say, overseas for a few weeks or a few months, sometimes they let their friends look after their house for that time. Because when there's a good friend inside the house, you know it's protected. And that's a third way of protecting the house, make sure there's good people in there. And to make sure those good people stay is a fourth way. For those of you who know the Buddha's teaching, that's called the four right efforts. The four right efforts to avoid or prevent unwholesome states of mind entering in the first place. If they enter, then do something to get them out. Call the police. And to invite good states of mind in, which is a third right effort. And once good states of mind come in, then maintain them, look after them. Make sure there's lots of food and goodies for your friends to keep them in the house as long as possible. Because when you have good friends inside the house, the thieves won't come and visit. They only like to go into empty houses. In the same way that if you've only got dullness or equanimity, no real joy and happiness in the mind, it's very easy for unpleasant states, unwholesome states to come in, because you've got no good states in there, no friends. So this is a simile of the gatekeeper for mindfulness. And extending that simile even further, if you've got a gatekeeper, you don't need to keep on giving instructions to the gatekeeper every 2 minutes. Now the owner of the nightclub just tells the bouncer in the afternoon before they open up, so this is what you should do, you're on duty from this time to that time, here's a list of the troublemakers, learn their names, know their characteristics, memorize their photographs. If you see them, this is what you should do. And then the owner just goes away and enjoys himself. And if you have confidence, the bouncer will do the job. You leave the guard there so you can relax. You don't need to worry about the valuables in your mansion. In the same way that the mindfulness, which is used in meditation, like a guard, like a bouncer, you do not need to keep on instructing that bouncer of your mind. And this is one of the great mistakes of meditators, when they misunderstand the power and the use of mindfulness. I've already mentioned this in the question time. At each stage of this meditation, you have to set up a bouncer, a guard in your mind. For example, in the first stage of the meditation, when we're doing present moment awareness, you tell this bouncer, this mindfulness, this ability of the mind to know, to recognize what you're doing, and also to remember what you're supposed to be doing, and to try and keep the two in line. You tell that bouncer, now I will go into the present moment. You have to know what the present moment is, very clearly. Because sometimes people come up to me and say, what actually is the present moment? What am I supposed to be looking at? And what you're supposed to be looking at is just the present moment, now. What's happening? It can be a thought, it can be a feeling, it can be a sound, a taste or a touch or whatever, as long as it's existing now. So you're looking at the content of the present moment. What's happening? If it is a thought, you're not getting dragged into the thought, which takes you into the past and the future. It's as if there is this thought of the past, and yet you see it, because you're in the present moment. This is a thought of the past happening now. But you keep it tied to the present moment. And you not only tell the gatekeeper, the bouncer, what it's supposed to be doing, you also have to identify the enemies, you know, the troublemakers. So the bouncer or the guard can know who to look out for and who to sort of to take precautionary measures so they don't get in. If they do go in, so he can pull them out again. So mindfulness not only knows what you're supposed to be doing, but also knows the troublemakers to that state. And the two troublemakers to the first stage of meditation, very easy to know, is the past and the future. So if you see those two hoodlums coming into your mind, the two troublemakers coming in there, and they try to sneak in, you tell mindfulness, watch out for those two guys. So often they've taken away my peace. They've stolen the great jewels of contentment and sense of ease. And they got me all worried again about the past and the future. So you have to tell that gatekeeper, if you see the past coming in or the future coming in, stop them, kick them out. But you also have to know that these defilements of the mind can be very sneaky. Sometimes you're quite peaceful in your meditation and a thought of the past comes up, and this is really interesting. Something, you know, you've been waiting to have a clear mind to think about, to deal with. And so you actually waste all this time thinking about the past. Or sometimes a thought of the future. And this is important. This troublemaker, this thief comes in sort of under the guise of something really important and essential. You must, you know, let me in. Do not be convinced by the sweet talk of the past and the future, trying to tell you they're important, they're valuable, and you should stop your meditation for a short while just to deal with them. Because once they're in the door, just one past thought will bring in all its friends. And you have heaps and heaps of past thoughts, and it'll fill your mind, and you won't be able to get rid of them once they're in. The same with the future. Once you start thinking about the future, then you're gone. Heaps of other future thoughts, future ideas, plans will all come in your mind, and you'll be lost again. So keep out each one. So the way you do this, the beginning of the meditation, when it's time for present moment awareness, you actually instruct your gatekeeper very clearly. Now is the time for present moment awareness. Now is the time for present moment awareness. Now is the time for present moment awareness. In Buddhism, we always do things three times, just to reinforce. And also, remind yourself of the enemies. Anything to do with the past, anything to do with the future, those are the two enemies. Watch out for them. Make sure they don't come in. If you set up mindfulness that way, then you can relax. What happens next, once you've relaxed, you just allow the mind to do the job. What happens is that the mind starts watching the present moment, watching the present moment, and the thought of the past or the thought of the future starts to try and come in. Then automatically the mind says no and pushes it away. And sometimes you can look upon that and wonder, am I doing that? Or what's doing that? Who's doing that? It's an automatic response because you've conditioned, you program the mind, or rather you set up mindfulness. It's the same thing. Programming the mind and setting up mindfulness, the same thing. You program the mind in that way. And it's wonderful when you see it works. You're sitting here, maybe after 5 or 10 minutes watching the present moment, a thought of the past or the future comes up, something says no, and you stop, and you stay with the present moment. That is how mindfulness works. But it can only work if you set it up carefully. When you do this, you have to do it carefully. So give it full attention. Whatever resolution, determination you have, whatever instructions you give to the gatekeeper or the guard, they have to be clear instructions. Again, one of the other reasons why meditation fails is People give themselves really unclear instructions. Just be peaceful. The mind doesn't know how to be peaceful. What do you mean by peaceful? Imagine telling your garden, gatekeeper, those sorts of things. When you don't give clear, precise instructions, the guard or the gatekeeper, the bouncer, doesn't know what to do. It can easily get confused. So make it very clear what you want mindfulness to do. And secondly, make sure that the guard is listening. Because if the guard isn't listening, sort of then, you know, make him clear instructions, but it's not hearing you. So there's two aspects, clear instructions and make sure you're listening fully. And that way, mindfulness is established and it does its work. This way of setting up mindfulness means you don't always need to get involved, always interfering and always disturbing the meditation. Mindfulness does the job. And also you get this guard over the mind, this supervisor, always looking over what's going on, remembering the instructions, being clear. It does the job of keeping those two in line. And very shortly, you actually get this present moment awareness. The guard keeps out the troublemakers, you just keep present moment awareness. And that aspect of mindfulness which knows what's going on feels satisfaction in a job well done. Because in each of these stages of meditation there is a natural happiness arises. It's freedom from a burden. You feel good that your home is safe from thieves. The owner of the club is happy that all their patrons are having a good time and they're making lots of money, because there's no troublemakers getting in. There's a sense of happiness when you get into the present moment. And it's good to know that happiness. This another aspect of mindfulness knows the results of what you do. And the cause and effect should be noticed. And if that effect is a very pleasant one, a very good one, then that actually encourages mindfulness to become even more strong. Because it's just the positive reinforcement of the gatekeeper. You're almost like giving him a reward. Well done. And if you give your gatekeepers rewards and tips, then they'll be even more keen to keep their job with such a nice employer. And so they'll be even more alert, more watchful, more skillful in keeping the instructions. So the reward in each stage of meditation is the happiness. And the second stage of the meditation, once the present moment is achieved and you're in the present moment, then sometimes this happens naturally, but if you want to progress it a bit more swiftly, you can actually tell the gatekeeper what to do next. And what you tell the gatekeeper is, now I want to be in silence. Know what silence is. In that simile of the television, it's just watching the screen, turning down the sound. So you're just knowing, rather than saying something back. You're listening fully without saying anything inside. This inner speech, this inner commentary is turned off. It's just silence. So you're aware without giving things a name, without noting, without trying to remember. Without doing anything. For those of you who always want to remember things, please understand that when mindfulness is that sharp and you're very silent, memory happens automatically. And the memory is much stronger and much sharper. If you're in a job or a profession where you have to develop your memory, this is one of the greatest ways of developing memory, to get into that silence, that present moment awareness, developed into silence. Then what you hear, what you see, you can remember very clearly. Because the impression of that experience is able to fully enter the mind without battling your words and ideas about it. So you don't need to worry about, I have to remember this. So know what that silence is. And know what the enemies to silence are. The most insidious of the enemies to silence is, again, this thing which we want to describe the silence. We want to give it a name. We want to try and encompass it with our thoughts. So have that courage just to let silence be. Don't try and understand it with language. Understand it with feeling. In meditation, I often tell people that meditation is an emotional path, a feely-feely path, not a sort of a namey-namey path. You actually feel your way into deep meditation, and that's why that sort of some people are not courageous enough, sort of have a hard time being silent. They always want to name things, to give it a title, because they feel more secure when they do things like that. So have the courage to know without saying. It goes against our educational system, where we think that knowledge comes from giving everything a name and classifying it and seeing the relationships between, not the things, but between the names. And then we get this whole literature and books all about some names and stuff. Even when I was a young monk, and I'm not even a young monk, a young Buddhist, there was this Zen monk came to England, and he could hardly speak any English. This was 30 years ago, 35 years ago, when Buddhism was starting to come over to the West. And someone invited this Zen monk over, and he gave a few lectures, but it was really hard to understand when it's going through an interpreter, but you didn't have much choice of lectures in those days, not like these days. We can go to all sorts of lectures on Buddhism. But anyhow, just as he was leaving, the one thing I always remember from his talk was when he was leaving that somebody asked a question. And said, what do you think about Buddhism in England? He stayed about 2 months, 3 months in England. What do you think about Buddhism in England? And this monk had learned a little bit of English, and so he answered the question himself this time. And what he said was this, he said, books, books, books. Too many, too many, too many. Dustbin, dustbin, dustbin. And he couldn't speak much English, but it's a very eloquent answer to the question. And it was so straight down the line, wasn't it? I think he also said later on, I never found this any sutras or any sort of teachings, but he said, anyone who writes a book gets reborn as a donkey for the next 7 lifetimes. But actually, why was he saying that? Why is sort of some of these meditation monks so against like books? One of the reasons is because then we just see the words rather than actually seeing the thing. And that's a problem for people. You know, when you see a person, you see the name. When you see their country, you don't see the person. When you go into like deep dhammas, you see like, say, impermanence. People just see the name, they don't actually see the thing underneath it. And this is why they also give the simile of like the menus. It's like people going to restaurants and eating the menu. There was actually, somebody told me this the other day. This was in India somewhere. This man went to see this doctor, and the doctor examined him and said, oh, you know, I can see what's wrong with you, and he wrote out a script and said, now, this is the medicine, take this 3 times a day, and when you're finished, come back and I'll give you some more. And so sort of he went away, and about 2 weeks later, no, only a week later, he came back and said, you're back early. And he said, how are you feeling? He said, I'm feeling so much better, doctor, but I need another script. Because I've already eaten this, I tore it into little bits and I ate one every day, one piece of bread every day. He said, oh, I feel so much better. Because he didn't understand, you've got to take the script to a chemist and get the medicine. He'd actually ate the paper. The amazing thing was, he felt better. But please, don't eat the menu. You might feel better. Now, go for what the menu is pointing to. That's why silence is so wonderful, because we're getting rid of all these words and menus. All these words, they're pointing to something, aren't they? That's why another little way of meditation, to try and get that mindfulness really going, This is, again, another way of instructing the gatekeeper. And especially if you've got a gatekeeper who's very stubborn and very stupid, then try this method of meditation. Mantras. Say a word to yourself, like love. Like love. Love. What's happening in your mind now? You get all nice and woozy. As soon as I say that, I'm pointing to something and the mind is following that. Hate. 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 Now what's that doing to the mind? These words have power. After you say a word, it has like an echo. You're pointing in a direction and the mind sees, you know, what you're pointing at. You look in that direction. And then you actually understand what these words are for. They point to something. That's all they are, just pointers. And it's important that you follow that pointer and see what the word means. The meaning of love was what you felt after I said that word. The meaning of hate was what you felt after I said that word. So you can try a little mantra. Silence. 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 Was silence there? Did you see it? A lot of times people say, yeah, they can. Sometimes they can't stop thinking. But as soon as you tell the gatekeeper in the right way, you can be silent. The important thing with mantras is that you don't just keep saying the word. You always give a pause after you've said the word. So give the word a chance to work. In the same way that a gatekeeper needs chance to do their job. So this is giving instructions to the gatekeeper. Silence. Silence. It's easy. So it's another way of actually helping the meditation along. At any stage of the meditation, if the gatekeeper is really stubborn and stupid, do those little mantras. But say it and wait for what I call the echo. And each time you say it, the echo should last longer. If it's silence, the actual experience of silence should last longer each time. Until you don't need to say the word anymore. You've got the silence. But just abide in it. And you can use that at any time of your day in your meditation. It's actually arousing mindfulness, telling the gatekeeper what to look out for, and the gatekeeper does it, and it knows. So there's many, many mantras you can use. The word peace, silence, emptiness. There's emptiness. Emptiness. It's there in front of you. So it's a good way of doing quick meditation. But when we get to the silence, the main enemies are just these first few words, labels, which then break into a whole realm of thought. One of the other enemies to that silence is this contemplation. Try to contemplate silence rather than experiencing it. Because a lot of times we try and contemplate things too quickly. Until really the contemplations I was saying last night should be done after the experience is finished. In the same way that those of you who like good music, now say you go and see a great concert, you have to listen to the concert fully. When it's finished and you're walking out with your friend, then you can discuss whether it's a great concert or a mediocre concert or a rubbish concert. But not during the concert. You don't interrupt and say, this is marvellous, this is wonderful. You get thrown out of the auditorium, wouldn't you, if you sort of start to talk to you in the middle of a great concert. And so you should be. Actually, you should be thrown out of the meditation hall. If you're having great sight, say, wow, this is great. Shut up. Wait until the thing is finished, first of all. Then you can contemplate. And you don't need to worry that you won't remember what happened. The important things you'll always remember. Have that courage to leave the silence alone and don't disturb it. You know, but you know without thinking, without writing a book about it. So have that mindfulness, really develop the silence. Again, first of all, tell the gatekeeper, this is what you're supposed to do, this is the two enemies, this is the enemy of silence, all this thinking, naming, noting, contemplating. And when you've told the gatekeeper very clearly, the mind will do the job, silence will come up, and actually you'll get used to silence. A lot of times, one of the biggest obstacles to silence is fear of silence. You're not used to it, you don't feel comfortable in silence because we've always been speaking and our security blanket is thinking. And when we have to give up that security blanket of thinking, we feel a bit sort of like naked. But the more you go into that silence, the more comfortable you feel with it, the more acquainted you are with that silence, then the more at ease you are. It's like sometimes in the interviews. Some people come into the interview room and they're so frightened of me. For those of you who know me for a long time, you know, you're accustomed to me, so you don't get afraid or nervous because you're used to me. In the same way, when you actually start going into silence, at first you might feel nervous and uncomfortable, but after a while you get used to that silence. And when you get used to it, it becomes a friend. When you're with a great friend, you're comfortable. And you don't want to disturb that relationship with silence. So that fear is one of the obstacles there to silence. As this meditation retreat goes on, you find it much more comfortable because outside is silence and that will resonate with the silence inside. But to go deeper in the meditation, you have to get into some sort of focus, and this is where we take on the breath. So the gatekeeper has to be instructed again. Okay, you got the first two stages pretty well down. Now, you actually interrupt the silence to tell the gatekeeper, but don't interrupt the silence too long. Tell the gatekeeper, now onto the breath. Now be aware of the breath, just the breath, nothing else. Any sound outside, I'm not going to be concerned about. Any feelings in the body, not now. Just the breath and nothing else. So you can see the obstacles to the breath. Sounds, feelings, thoughts, those are obstacles. Those are the troublemakers. Because once you start to get into feelings of the body, usually it's pain or it's heat, you're not comfortable. But when you're actually with the breath, alone with the breath, there's no trouble at all. When I was a young monk in Thailand, we used to have the problem with mosquitoes. Because we didn't have any mosquito repellent, and this was the first year in this monastery in Thailand, which became the Wat Nanachat. And the first few weeks actually, and Ajahn Chah used to come every evening to do some chanting and sit meditation with everybody. And so maybe about 70 or 80 villagers, and Ajahn Chah, the great teacher, and a few other monks, we'd sit outside because there was no hall, sit under the trees at dusk when all the mozzies came out. And these mosquitoes in Thailand, they've been like genetically bred to know that monks were a safe meal. We weren't allowed to sort of squash them. So if they saw a monk, it was whoopee. Now I can have drink as much as I like without having to worry about being swatted. So when they saw monks, they'd all tell their friends and all come. And especially like Western, because also, you know, you're all covered up. You know, you have to cover up your shoulders, you've got hair on your head. Monks have got so much more exposed skin, so much more choice of tables by which to eat. So that these mosquitoes, and also because you're Western, because the Thai mosquitoes should be, they always can, they can get Thai food any time, but Western food was something new. So they always go for the Westerners. And so you'd be sitting there, sort of being eaten alive by mosquitoes. And it was very, very hard to endure. And quite a few times you just want to run away. Because there's no repellent, there's no place to to go. Your teacher was there and all these lay people, and you were supposed to be a monk and tough. And pride kept you sitting there. But we used to count mosquitoes. He's dead now. This friend of mine was also a monk at the time. The mosquitoes didn't get him. It was a car crash later on and killed him. But he was. We used to count the mosquitoes on our arms. And we used to get to around about 40 or 50 when we couldn't count them anymore. Because they were too close together. You know, there was no actual resolution between the sort of the sites. Because they were too close. And I'm not joking, that's about the number we used to get to. And it was really hard to endure. Not only that, was this noise of slurp, slurp, slurp. You can feel the blood being sucked out of you. But at least I had had some experiences in meditation before I was a monk. So what I did after a while, it was unendurable. For me anyway, because I wasn't that tough. So what I did, I watched the breath instead. And every time my mind slipped from the breath, it would go straight to my arm or my head, and this was unendurable. So because of the irritation, you just go straight back to the breath, and you wouldn't dare to take your attention away from the breath. And I used to get some amazing samadhi, amazing states of meditation, thanks to those mosquitoes. They really kept my mindfulness on the job. Actually trained me how to really be mindful, because any slip and ow. So that way I used to get these lovely meditations, and actually I thank those mosquitoes for teaching me about mindfulness, because if you're aware of your breath, you're not aware of any other part of your body, and you can't even feel those mosquitoes biting you. And the other strange thing, which was interesting, that when you came out of meditation afterwards, there was no bumps on your arm, no welts. Those welts had all gone, and all the mosquitoes had gone as well. So meditation has got some marvellous powers to it. But anyway, what it was teaching was how to meditate on the breath. You have to actually stay with the breath all the time. You don't let it go even a tiny bit. When you focus that way, you get energy, you get power, you get a sense of stillness, because you're not moving, and also you get a lot of happiness. So this was telling me what the mind should do. My gatekeeper got very well trained by those mozzies. So you train your gatekeeper. You tell him this stage, the breath, nothing else. Any other thought, even contemplating what the breath means, any other noise, feeling in the body, no way. Straight back to the breath. If you set up that gatekeeper that way, you stay with the breath, there's no trouble at all. And then after a while you start to move off, the gatekeeper stops you, back to the breath. Start to stray off, back to the breath. You don't do it, the gatekeeper does. And that way you can focus on the breath very easily. I should actually mention what we mean by focusing on the breath, because some people again get confused. The instructions have to be very clear. That which tells you what the breath is doing, whether it's going in or whether it's going out. The feeling of the breath. It does not matter where that feeling is. When the Buddha taught breath meditation, he wasn't talking nose meditation. Not stomach meditation, but breath meditation. It can be anywhere as long as you know it's the breath. Sometimes people say they can't do this. And usually the psychology to show them they can. I've already done this a couple of times in the interviews. I ask people to breathe in and out three times. You do it now. Breathe in and out three times. That's breath meditation. Now just do it 3,000 times. It's easy. What you're watching in that exercise is what you have to watch in breath meditation. That's what breath meditation is. Watching that very same thing. So once you know what it is, then it becomes much easier to instruct the gatekeeper. With that breath meditation, there comes a time when you calm it down. And you can even tell that gatekeeper, calm it down. Calm, calm, calm. when instead of an ordinary breath, you just really relax and open up to the whole breath, beginning to end. This is when you are fully mindful of the breath. In meditation we talk about one-pointedness. But that one-pointedness should not be understood as one-pointedness in space. It doesn't matter if it's the tip of your nose. Don't even worry about your nose. Let go of the nose. It's one-pointedness in time. One-pointedness in time means it's the same perception, moment after moment after moment. It's called sustained attention. Things aren't moving. Same experience. That's called stillness. That's called peace. Nothing is changing, happening. This is the goal of that stage of the meditation. To get this even, still, unchanging, almost beautiful breath all the time. And nothing else is in the mind. So you can't hear sounds. You can even do that with your walking meditation. Set up mindfulness. Tell the gatekeeper, I'm going to walk backwards and forwards. Present moment awareness, first of all. What are the enemies? Know the enemies. Know what you're supposed to be doing. And let mindfulness do the job. Silence. Okay, now to be silent. Mindfulness, this is what you should do. This is what you should be aware of. This is what you can't do. These are the enemies, the troublemakers. Don't let them in. And then let mindfulness work. Watching the feet. Move. The left foot, the right foot, knowing every moment. No other thoughts, no other sounds. Don't listen to the birds when you're watching the feet. See what happens. It gets a very powerful, deep sense of stillness and peace. I used to do this in my first year in Thailand. I was staying in a monastery in Bangkok. And it was just the main hall. I used to walk from one end to the other and then back again. I was so peaceful, I'd go so slow. It took me half an hour to go for this, probably not much longer from this wall over here to the wall over there. It took me half an hour to get from one place to another because it was a big grandfather clock which chimed the quarter hours. And about half an hour to go back again. And that was my hour's walking meditation. And you get so still and peaceful. You couldn't move fast because there's so much going on in the movement of the feet. That you'd actually, if you move too quickly, you'd miss too much. So every little movement, it wasn't force, it was very natural. Every little movement, you could feel it going forward and backwards and going forward. It was delightful. I remember once what happened was, I forgot that they was having a ceremony and I had to sort of leave early. So they sent this monk after me to come get me. And so this monk came running in and saying, no, Bamawangso, you've got to come to the ceremony. And I was like halfway in a step when he came. And it was like just a voice from a long, long way away trying to catch my attention. But I realized it was important. So as soon as I heard the voice, I was trying as hard as I could to come actually out and speak to him. This is actually just, well, I just moved my head just so slowly because moving my head, which is so interesting. And then I moved it sort of just very gently about this speed. And I managed to get out, pardon? It was just so hard to get out, even though I knew it was important, because you were just so still and so peaceful. Some people call that being attached to serenity. Great, that's what you're supposed to be doing. There's nothing wrong with that, that's good. You're just letting go of complexity, letting go of noise. So really get into these states of meditation. Not only do you actually set up mindfulness this way, but afterwards when you come out, you find this thing called awareness is increasing and increasing and increasing in its brightness. That's why you become more aware of the refined and subtle things going on. Awareness is like a light. Mindfulness is like a light which you shine on the world, on reality. So often that light is so dim that we can't see hardly anything at all. When we turn that light up, we turn up the voltage and it starts to get very bright, then we can see so much more. To turn the voltage up, we have to be very still.
very one point of actually building up energy on energy on energy. And if you really get into the deep meditations, your mindfulness is just like this searchlight which the army uses, which is so strong, you can point it anywhere. And just you see things you never thought you'd see before, which you couldn't see were there because your mindfulness wasn't strong enough, wasn't bright enough, wasn't energetic enough. So this is actually setting up mindfulness, how it works. You don't need to just set it up during the meditation, you can set it up other times of the day as well. When you're eating, remember, one spoon at a time. When you start to eat the food, tell yourself, this is what I'm going to do. And do the one spoon at a time practice. Eat one spoon, taste it. Only when it's finished will I put it down and start again. In other words, then I'll decide what I'm going to eat next. Be quiet when you're eating. Present moment awareness and silence. I'm really amazed actually that people in the world, they go to these expensive restaurants and they have this really delicious... That chat, they might as well be eating rubbish for all they actually taste, because only maybe a moment that they taste it and then they're back in the conversation. And sometimes they're talking so much they don't know what they're eating. And really, if you really go to an expensive restaurant, you should tell your partner, shut up, look, I paid a lot of money for this food, I want to get my money's worth. I want to taste every piece of this food, because this is amazing taste. So really, in expensive restaurants, people should actually eat in silence, so they're not distracted from the taste of the food. And if there's a band or music playing in the restaurant, that shows the food must be terrible, because they're trying to distract you from what it really tastes like. So you can actually see that the mindfulness is actually being with what's happening. So you can set up mindfulness when you're eating. You can set up mindfulness when you go to the toilet. Silence. On the toilet, it's a great place for people to contemplate. But how about being silent instead? So you can set up mindfulness throughout the day when you go to bed at night. Sometimes in retreats we don't have much time to sleep. So if you have to sleep only a few hours, you've got to sleep efficiently. So set up mindfulness before you go to sleep. Remind yourself what you're supposed to do. This is sleep time. Rest in the body. Give yourself some loving kindness. Good night, me. Have a nice night's sleep. Present moment awareness. Don't take what's happened beforehand during the day into your sleep. Don't carry the burden of tomorrow into tonight. Let go of all past and future. And let go of all this thinking. Got to get up at 4 o'clock. Got to get up at 4 o'clock. I'm a bell ringer tomorrow. What will happen if I don't get up in the morning? Everybody will know I didn't get up in the morning. So I'm a bell ringer tomorrow morning. Oh God, what's going to happen? You keep ringing up. 3 o'clock, 3:10, 3:30. So just go to sleep. And don't carry the burden of tomorrow into tonight. That way you can sleep peacefully. Present moment awareness and silence. You know what it is, sometimes you can't go to sleep at night? I've got to get up early in the morning, I've got to give a talk, I've got to go here. That worry keeps you awake. I just said, I don't care, I can lay awake all night. You know how comfortable your bed is? I don't know about the bed here, but the bed at home. It's great, isn't it, just staying awake all night, because you're in this comfortable bed all night. It's nice and warm and soft, and the pillow's just really nice. What do you want to go to sleep for? So this is just like a little way of saying, I don't mind staying awake. And as soon as you don't mind staying awake, then you go to sleep. So that's the little tricks of the trade on how to go to sleep when you've got, if you had too much coffee or tea, or you're too wound up. Just don't care about going to sleep. You don't start thinking. Then you just go to sleep naturally. So these are like mindfulness techniques. So remember that mindfulness, how it works. Gatekeepers, bouncers, giving instructions. Know what those instructions should be in the meditation, in the sitting meditation, in the walking meditation, the sleeping meditation, in the eating meditation, in the going to the toilet meditation. If you do it mindfully, it's meditation. If it's leading to quiet, alertness, it's meditation. Even what I was saying about the hindrances yesterday, like the symbol of the snake is just setting up mindfulness. The mind, setting up the gatekeeper, these are the real bandits. the hindrances. Watch out for them. If you do that mindfully, set up the mindfulness sort of carefully, then mindfulness has a chance of defeating all those defilements. And your path into meditation will become much more smooth, far more effective. That's how mindfulness works. Any questions? Yeah.
During a sitting meditation, my mind is fully aware, and sometimes I feel that I think less or think nothing at all. But there was something happening that seemed to be a lot of energy and body heat up. Is that because of I eat too much or because of the mind is very awake and also I think less?
Very often, if you have some of those physical experiences, like getting very hot or moving or energy jerks in the body, at those stages of meditation, these are very good signs. Because so often we're so repressed because of our thoughts. You know, always just controlling. So often that when you get a little bit of peacefulness, it's like blockages sort of open up, like channels start to be released, and energy starts to flow, and the body starts to balance. If you get like great rushes of energy, or sort of heat, or sort of twitches or something, that's a good sign of things being released. So just let it go. Just follow it. This is interesting, but don't make it a big problem. It'll just disappear by itself, and everything will get peaceful afterwards. Because of like thoughts and worries, and fears and guilt, we just really screw up this body quite a lot. And when you actually let go, you're not just letting go of the mind, just the body's letting go as well. And things have a chance to sort of wash through, and the body starts to balance. The body's a great healer, if you can only give it a chance. I always tell them, if you've got sort of a cut on your finger, what's the best way to get rid of a cut on the finger? Put a band-aid on it and leave it alone. But what most people do, they put a band-aid on, 5 minutes later is it healed yet? No. Maybe put some ointment on. Cut off. That's the wrong ointment, try another ointment. And because they're always messing around with it, doesn't give the body a chance. So, give it some peace. And let the body heal itself. So you don't worry at all. Just completely let go and be as peaceful as you can. Let's see if you can feel just sort of energy flows going through the body. Especially like lots of nice heat coming up. It's a really good sign. The body's starting to do things. And just flow with that.
Video has more impingement than audio. So that is why you are here to start when we meditate.
Mm-hmm.
But don't you think it's even better if you don't plug your ears?
Yes.
Plug up your ears.
It's actually interesting, actually, which is the strongest sense. Like, we do spend a lot of time looking and seeing, and that's actually what we know of the world, but our safety mechanism is our ears. That's why it's the last sense which turns off before you go into the deep meditation. The body disappears, feeling disappears much sooner. The last thing which goes before you enter the jhanas is sound. That's why the Buddha said that sound is the thorn to the deep meditations. It can find its way in there. In the same way that a cat goes to sleep, but its ears are still listening. Because it needs those ears to protect it while it's sleeping. And this is our last security alarm. Even when you're asleep, what wakes you up? Sound.
Mm-hmm.
Burglar.
If I am partially deaf, so I put on a hearing aid. But is it all right if I just switch it off?
Absolutely. Switch it off. If I could do that, I'd take the ears off as well. If I could find the screw, I'd screw them off and take them out. Yeah, it's great. So yeah, turn your hearing on and just have a nice time.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually sometimes I know another person like that was, I don't know if I should say this, that there was this husband who was married, and he said, he said, when my wife is going, I just turn my head on. So it's a fortunate affliction.
But if that's the case, you won't do much insight, isn't it?
Insight comes later. Get some peace, first of all. Because a lot of people have got insight into like sounds, insight into sights. They haven't got any insight into peace. We want to get insight into silence, insight into emptiness, insight into absolute stillness. Not insight into activity. I want to find, what's the other side of all this?
The insight is the insight to truth.
To?
Truth.
To
see things as they are. And you know that a sound is love, it should be love.
Yeah, but we want to find out what happens when all those sounds disappear. And we want to get that perspective. So when all the sounds go, it's when all of the sights go. And all the feelings go, and all the thoughts go, what's that like? Now those are the real insights which give you the full data. When we've only got half the data, we know sounds but we don't know silence. We know things but we don't know emptiness. Then we've only got half the truth. And it's not good enough. This is why that you've already thought enough about sounds. You know enough about sights. You've been in many places in the world. If you haven't actually been there, you can see videos of them these days. So you've seen all this, but we haven't seen emptiness and silence. We might be able to think about these things, but I'm talking about experiencing them. So all these things go for a while. Experience emptiness, nothingness, everything's disappeared. Experience bliss, and then you know suffering. So this is why we do this path of meditation. Remember the Buddha, before he sat under the Bodhi tree, he'd had lots and lots of experiences. He had a very sharp mind, he contemplated so much, but wasn't enlightened. That's why he did these meditations under the Bodhi tree, to see what it's like when everything goes. And that's how he became enlightened. Not through listening, but through turning away from listening. Not through seeing, but through closing his eyes. Not through thinking, for stopping all thoughts, not to feeling the body, but going to the mind where no body exists, going to the very, very deep meditations. That's where the Buddha did it. That's where all the other enlightened monks, nuns, people have done it since. So don't try and find a shortcut. Otherwise you waste a lot of time. Any other questions? Yeah?
tell
your mindfulness at each stage, is okay?
Yeah.
If you want to give the gatekeeper the full instructions,
yeah.
That's sometimes a bit complex. After a while of telling your gatekeeper again and again and again, being methodical, then the gatekeeper doesn't hardly need to be told anymore. You know, you say, where are you going? Go to meditation. He knows exactly what to do. So this is great when you've been like a monk many years. You don't need to tell your gatekeeper much at all. You sit down, the gatekeeper knows exactly what to do and when to do it. And you just sit there, let go, and enjoy the journey.
Mm.
So, but that's only through practice, 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 until the gatekeeper becomes very sharp and very, very well trained.
So you're aware of different things, where you are.
That's right, yeah. And your mind just changes automatically when it's the right time. This is especially true of the deeper stages of the meditation, which I'll talk about later on. Because at these stages, you just cannot interrupt. And it has to become very an automatic process. And why do you actually go from the next stage to the next stage or from this jhana to the next jhana? It's because of the programming. It has to be done sort of automatically without you're not there anymore to give instructions. One of these monks is Ajahn Mahabua, one of the great monks in Thailand. He gave this story like
before he was a monk, he used to be a boxer, you know, in that Thai boxing. And he used to say that when you're actually in the ring, you can't make any decisions because everything is going so fast, you're just reacting. And if you react in the correct way, it's because how you've trained. And it's the same in meditation. How you train, you know, you train your gatekeeper, but actually when you're right in deep meditations, you can't give any advice at all to yourself. You can't tell yourself what to do. It all becomes automatic. And if you're giving your gatekeeper great instructions, very smart instructions, you can go very deep. You can win the match. Okay, so that's enough for now because it's interview time.